Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time streaming or downloading the program, Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or just trying to make life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Today I talked to Eli Ritter. You may remember Eli as a candidate for Ward 4 City Councilor in the recent municipal election here in Guelph, but hopefully you will come to know him better in the months to come as a contributor to Guelph Politico. This podcast is the start of those efforts, what is hopefully going to be an ongoing feature where Eli and I sit down once a month and talk about what we're euphemistically calling the Guelph stuff. A frank and open conversation about anything and everything politically related to the Royal City. The Guelph stuff is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. So if you don't know Eli, or don't know him beyond the fact that he ran for office, he's a third-year media studies student at the University of Guelph-Humber campus, and he is the founding editor-in-chief of the Avro Post, a student-run publication at Guelph-Humber. Clearly a glutton for punishment, I started talking to Eli after the election about contributing to Guelph Politico with the occasional written piece and this new monthly podcast feature we're calling Guelph Stuff. In terms of the goal, this is something we sometimes try to do on Open Sources Guelph, but since the beat of Open Sources is local, provincial, national, and global, it's sometimes hard to get back to things on a Guelph level. So we're going to highlight them in these dedicated episodes of the Politicast, and Eli's going to help with that. So this will be a round robin of three topics. For this inaugural Guelph stuff, we're going to begin by tackling the debate over closed meetings, and then we'll talk about the provincial government's move on high-speed rail and the doubt now sown into those developments, and we will wrap up with a look ahead to what the dynamics of the new council might look like. We sometimes go off topic, but I hope this comes across as an engaged and informed discussion about Guelph issues between two people with more than a passing interest in the subject. I guess you will have to determine. So, that's it for the preamble. Let's get into it. I caught up with Eli Ritter about Guelph stuff earlier this week. So, Eli Ritter, thank you for joining me on this new Politicast adventure.
It's going to be good.
You can't guarantee that.
I can believe it.
All right, fair enough. So the title of this, and we're going to make it a semi-regular thing, is Guelph Stuff. So we're going to talk about Guelph stuff that's in the news. And one of the things I think that came out of the last council meeting, certainly the biggest thing that came out of the last council meeting, was the discussion about the closed meeting, or the closed meeting nature of we're already screwing up. I'm trying to remember the tag group, the technical advisory group that is talking about Claire Maltby, that's coming up with that plan. I want to talk, first of all, that, you know, you are in the journalism craft too. So I wanted to just to get your feelings on the idea of all these closed meetings, or the idea of closed meetings, and where you're coming from on it.
Well, my initial thought is that's kind of not so good. Mm-hmm. Kind of shady.
Right.
Why do you need a closed meeting? And then I want to find out, right? But, you know, I can also understand that maybe there's circumstances for it. And you're a veteran of this. If anyone in Guelph's a veteran of this, it's you. And I'm sure there's reasonable reasons. But
right.
My initial reaction is, you know, what the heck's going on in the closed meeting?
Right. Well, so. That's always, I think, the action. I think, like, the Municipal Act lays out very particular circumstances for a closed meeting. You know, it involves, like, risk to a person, legal liability. But I think there's a fine line. And I think, I don't know where that is, because it's almost like you can't have the whole discussion because you don't know what is happening in a closed meeting. So you can't, like, really cite specific example. Like, well, the reason why we had this closed meeting is because A, B, and C. And you have to sort of take it as an article of faith that the integrity commissioner and the council and, you know, are making the right decisions. But I know I get frustrated when, you know, Cam Guthrie comes out at the beginning of the open session and says, oh, you know, in the interest of transparency, and he always says that. And it's not like I find it disingenuous or anything, but he says, like, in the interest of transparency, we talked about issue A
in the closed meeting because of reason B, and then we gave staff direction or they gave us information. And I feel like it's an invitation to sort of fill the void. You know, we have people, you know, it's sort of the nature of today that we just don't trust the institutions. And so to say, like, trust us.
Just because
the Municipal Act says it's okay.
Right.
It's dicey.
Question for you.
Yeah.
So during the Guelph Hydroelectra process,
mm-hmm.
there were a few closed meetings there, was there not?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I know one of the big things talking to people around Guelph was that they found that it wasn't transparent.
Right.
For some people, and whether that's true or not, I can't judge that. But and part of that might be because of all these closed meetings, and
right.
it's a perception to the public, and you know, so maybe he has to realize that the mayor and councilors, I guess too, has to realize that that is what's going to happen as a result of that, and should address that maybe.
That the result of the closed meetings is distrust.
Yeah, among the general populace in Guelph.
Right. Well, I think the hydro merger is an interesting example of that, because I think there was maybe, I don't know, again, because I don't know what was in the closed meeting, but or sort of where the legal line is. But it seemed like closed meeting, we got information, we were given direction, and then one day it was announced that there was this merger happening.
Yeah.
And it feels like maybe there could have been a step in there, like we're actively discussing a merger. You know, maybe you don't have to say who exactly or what exactly is sort of in, because, you know, negotiations do sort of depend on a certain amount of confidentiality, and we saw that like in the most macro way possible with the NAFTA renegotiations.
Yeah.
But there has to be a way to say that this is something that is going to be happening, watch for it.
And I think that, you know, the media's job is to hold the government accountable, right? And to get...
Ideally,
yeah, in the best scenario. And, you know, you want to get the information to the public. And if you're inhibited... you know, by these meetings, these closed door meetings, and that doesn't help anyone. And the difference between these closed meetings and maybe some that have been in the past, and the USMCA renegotiation or NAFTA renegotiation, is that Chrystia Freeland made herself available constantly to the press.
Right.
I would be watching CBC News, and after any major development, she would be right there on the U.S. Trade Building. I mean, I know what the U.S. Trade Building looks like now because she's been on the news.
She lived
so
there
much.
For 3 months.
Exactly. So, and, you know, she was, there had to be some quietness around it, and she couldn't give everything away, of course. But she was there and accessible, and you had a feeling that we were going through this together as a country.
Mm-hmm.
And at a micro scale, maybe that's how Guelph should be doing it. And I don't know if people felt that way during the merger.
Like a mayor scrum after the meeting or something.
Yeah, that would be great.
Even though there's three of us.
Yeah. Hey, but you know what? It works.
No, that's interesting, because I feel like maybe it has to do with the procedural bylaw. Maybe it's good that we have, you know, procedural bylaws, but, you know, maybe there is maybe too much of a separation, too much of a distance, I guess, you know, too much of a acceptance of, you know, this is an affair where there are very set rules to govern what is happening. And maybe there isn't that kind of interrogativeness, you know, maybe there's value in just, and again, maybe that's going to be dependent on the public too, because one of the things I note is that people pay attention when it's controversial and when it affects them. And so if you say, like, okay, one meeting a month, we're going to put aside like 45 minutes for people to just come up and have a rake out about, you know, stuff, you know, yeah. What would, I mean, I have a feeling the first couple of meetings like that would probably get a lot of attention, but you know, what would happen in the subsequent meetings? Would that just become a thing that, you know, maybe one person or two people show up for?
Right. And it's not, it wouldn't be a thing that would be for someone to chew out the mayor or council
right.
or something like that. It's right. just to be part of the process, really, mm-hmm. and feel like, you know, you're on your side. And it can be dangerous. It can be a dangerous precedent if these kind of things continue, mm-hmm. Especially since now the mayor can claim quite a majority mandate. A pretty strong mandate, objectively, mm-hmm. and you know, and he could say, "Look, I have this mandate. People put the trust in me, but there still needs to be accountability, no matter who you are."
Right. So. It just, yeah. I think in the meantime, I get struck by what Amberly Gaffel, the Integrity Commissioner Robert Swayze, said the last time, that, you know, maybe council's a little too quick to go into the closed meeting. That, you know, they're erring on the side of caution, which on one hand is good, but on the other hand, I think council has to accept there's a lot of suspicion. Well, you know, it's justified in some cases, it's not justified all the time, but, you know, that just the nature of the words, I think the words closed meeting invite, I guess, some degree of skepticism in terms of, you know, what council is doing behind closed doors. And the other thing is, I say the council is fairly tight about what goes on behind those closed doors. And I speak as someone who put a crack in that yeah. seal.
No, and you've been covering it for a while.
Yeah.
No, exactly. And I think that, you know, to Guelph residents listening to this, you have a job too, right? In democracy. And it's not just the media job or Adam's job to hold them accountable. It's also, you know, part of your duty as
right.
as a citizen. So, you know, maybe take the time, even if it's once a year, take yourself, your spouse, if you have kids, take your kids, go to a council meeting, engage in democracy. I mean, it's right there. May not be the most exciting thing all the time, but
can confirm.
Yeah, you know what? Turn on tweet notifications for Adam's Twitter and keep tabs on what's going on. But you know what? You could show up, and because council will listen to you because you're the voter. So
right.
you know they want to stay elected, and so if you're, you know, raising some suspicions, or if you're raising your voice about something, then they're going to have to listen.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So
great point. Moving on to topic number two,
yep.
where people are not necessarily listening, certain people in Queen's Park. It looks like we're taking a step back on high-speed rail. That was an announcement this week that not so much that the project's been canceled, but that the Ontario government is sort of looking at expanding the look at high-speed rail. They're looking at, you know, do we need high-speed rail? Instead, they're looking at maybe adding more VIA trains. What are the possibilities of that? And building more roads, adding more GO buses. Our mayor, Mayor Guthrie, wants to be a part of that review because it was kind of a big deal that Guelph sort of busted in Kool-Aid Man style to make sure that we were a stop on the high-speed rail train. And I think, you know, having commuted to Toronto one day last week, I wouldn't mind if that trip was, you know, an hour shorter. I think that would help me out a lot if I wanted to go to Toronto for the day. But yeah. what are you thinking about high-speed rail? You probably heard a lot about it on the campaign trail.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is, you know, it would be really cool to see that, to get to Toronto, because I am normally a student in Toronto.
That's right, yeah.
So I am going there all the time. I have close loved ones that go to Toronto all the time on transit. And so I've been through the whole refurbishing of Union Station. I've been through them trying to add more GO trains and more GO buses. And I've taken a GO thing any time of day, any time of week. So I've been there and I've experienced it. So it could definitely use improvement.
I don't remember a time when Union Station wasn't being refurbished.
Oh yeah. Oh no.
Yeah. No. Like I did work in Toronto 2 days a week. Like 10 years ago.
Right.
And yeah, I don't remember that place not having like construction in it.
Look, I will. Yeah. That, yeah, it's bad. But I will hand it to Metrolinx. You got to give credit where credit's due. And I think that the new sort of York concourse for people who have not been there yet, it looks good. They have the McDonald's, they have the Tim Hortons, they have the Essentials. Right? The early morning GO trip stuff. And it's easy to find things now. You can kind of read the signs for the ones that aren't falling down. But look, back to the high-speed rail thing. I mean, I heard from people going doors to doors, and full disclosure to anyone listening to this, I was a candidate in the last municipal election, Ward 4, and I knocked on thousands of doors. But I heard a lot about the high-speed rail from people and from a few people. And, you know, they seem to be in favor of it because it would allow more people to engage in the economy of Guelph from Toronto, and then Guelph also going to Toronto, so more people living here.
And stops along the way.
Yeah, exactly. And but you were talking about how you know, they would have to build whole new infrastructure for Guelph.
Yeah,
if that was going to happen.
Well, the timetable, because the original Wynn government timetable was like 2025. This was going to go in service, which was always super ambitious because we can't even get all day GO train service.
Yeah,
and that's been promised since I think 2014, 2015 that this was like the next thing. But yeah, there's a number of roads in Guelph, and if you live along the tracks or live close to the tracks, you will know that the GO train goes past, and they're railway crossings. The roads go over the tracks.
Yep.
And those roads will have to be buried if high-speed rail were to be constructed. And that would be like the major Guelph piece of this, is to bury those roads and turn them into underpasses or overpasses, or, you know, whichever way that works. And that would have its own series of environmental assessments and planning meetings and all that. So, you know, 2025 was always going to be super ambitious.
Yeah.
Just for that reason. But it makes me sad that, I mean, it was always sort of inevitable with Doug Ford getting elected that high-speed rail was...
would be chopped.
Not long. I was going to say not long for this world.
Yeah.
But there you go. It seems like we're prolonging the inevitable by having a conversation and where it's like, well, can we have more VIA trains? Well, that's not even provincial jurisdiction. Can we build more roads? Well, studies show you build more roads, you create more traffic.
Exactly.
It's, you know, more GO buses. Yes, that would be nice. But
it's not the future, though.
Well, it's not the future, and there's like some degree of, I've been meaning to make time to try and figure this out, because there's some belief that Greyhound has exclusive contract to run buses, like express buses between, or direct buses rather, from Toronto to Guelph, and then from Guelph to Kitchener. That's Greyhound's territory, and thus Metrolinx, as the provider of GO buses, can't horn in on that, which is why if you want to take the GO bus to Kitchener, you have to go through Aberfoyle.
Right.
Or why if you want to go to Toronto on the GO bus, you have to go through Mississauga or Brampton.
This is confirmed then?
I don't know if it's confirmed.
No, okay.
That's what I'm trying to get at. Liz Sandals told me that.
Oh.
But I've also heard other people say like that's like urban legend stuff that that Greyhound has this mysterious like ironclad contract from the Iron Bank of whatever to only run buses, you know. It's but I mean that's one of the things that this would have to solve or assure you know, once and for all, as if we're going to remote GO buses. And I'm not saying GO buses aren't part of the solution either, but right. I think the broader solution involving GO buses is not necessarily putting more buses on the 401 to get to Toronto. It's putting more buses on Highway 6 to get you to Hamilton, or to get you to Cambridge, or to get you to London, or
exactly
anywhere where it's difficult to find public transit service to.
Look, if you look at Europe, usually they're ahead of us in some different ways, arguably, and one of those is definitely transit. I mean, they had this kind of infrastructure set up 50 years ago, so... and Japan has this, so it seems odd to me that Canada, as a G7 and G20 country, arguably an economic powerhouse. I know we're next to the States, so sometimes it's hard to say that, but if you look at us overall in the world, we're an economic powerhouse, so there should be no issue for us to set up this kind of infrastructure, especially in this area, which is the most populous, the richest area in Canada. So the richest area of a G7 country should be able to handle setting up decent public transportation, especially considering we had it in the past when there was light rail transit from downtown Toronto. You could take a streetcar or similar kind of vehicle all the way to downtown Guelph.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've gone backwards, a step backwards since then. And, you know, I think that this high-speed rail eventually will be something that will happen. It's just a matter of when, like you're pointing out. So, I mean, hopefully advocates can push for it to happen faster, because it's arguably good for everybody, right? Gets more people off the road. But, you know, we'll see how fast that'll go.
Mm-hmm. I also wanted to point this out, too, that... The portion of Highway 7 being constructed between Kitchener and Guelph, the new portion,
right,
that's been delayed now.
Okay.
This delayed project has been delayed further. And you would think if there was one thing Doug Ford would get behind is the building of more roads. But, you know, they're saying they're putting a pause on it to try and find, quote unquote, savings. And, you know, good luck. I think we all like savings. But, it's a bit... There's something going on here where a lot of the stuff that's sort of been in progress and been expected, where, you know, now are suddenly, even things you would think would fit with the Ford agenda, like building a new road, are just not happening. And it feels like, you know, we're losing time or wasting time. And, you know, I'm not a fan of expanding highways for sure, but I mean, this was in progress there. That whole area just on the other side of the Hanlon, where the Hanlon ends at Woodlawn, has been sort of clear cut and made ready. And now we're going to be, you know, waiting for a few years to see what, if anything, happens.
Well, it seems strange that now would be the time to look for infrastructure savings, because usually in a time that the economy is doing well,
right,
a government looks to invest, you know, build the roads, build the transit, build the things that will be there for when the economy is not doing well.
Right. That would encourage economic growth when, yeah.
Exactly. So it almost seems backwards, and I don't want to inject too much of my own opinion in there, but, you know, it does seem weird that he wouldn't get behind something like that. And I think that it's up to maybe individual municipalities to push for it and to fight for it.
Right.
You know, we'll see if he'll clamp down on municipalities like he did Toronto. You know, that was unprecedented.
Yeah.
Or whether he'll be able to work with them. And that'll be up to people like our mayor, right?
Right.
And, you know, how much they can collaborate.
Yeah. Well, speaking of new governments and new municipalities, we're recording on Sunday, so a little over a week from when the new council is inaugurated. I know you wanted to be a part of the new council, couldn't quite make the cut, as it were, but
not this time.
We admire your ambition. But do you have thoughts about, you know, what you're expecting, you know, or what you think this new council, because, you know, I think a lot of people are expecting business as usual, because it's, you know, there's just the two new faces that we're replacing retiring councillors, or maybe, you know, two new young faces might shake things up. I don't know. I'm not giving you a chance to answer my questions.
Hey, no, that's good. it gives me a chance to think about it.
Good.
Keep going. No. I think that it'll be exciting to see what some of these new faces will do, especially O'Rourke. I think, you know, she had a really intense campaign. It was really awesome. And, you know, she comes from a little bit of my background, the marketing communication stuff, which is really neat. So that'll be exciting to have that fresh voice. I think that the new council has to remember that at least for certain wards, maybe two or three of them, a majority of the people in the ward did not vote for them. So they voted for other people that came behind them, but a majority of the votes, or at least a large chunk of them, went to the people that went to other people. And they were divided so that they, you know, they didn't beat the incumbents, obviously. But just to keep that in mind, to keep them in check, and to say, look, obviously there's issues and that we need to approach things differently. Especially in Ward 4, I can tell you that, you know, there was a lot of votes that went to there was a lot of people running in the ward, to be honest.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was about four of us that were around 800, 900 votes, right?
Right.
And that would, all of ours combined would beat any of the incumbents.
Right.
So that's just something to remember. And I know people can vote for two people on the ballot, so it's hard to actually break down those numbers. But so we'll see whether things do change. Because that, going back to your actual question, was are we going to see a change? And I mean, I want to almost send that back to you, because I haven't been watching council as long as you. Mm. So do you think that maybe, what do you think? Do you think that they'll be shaken up, or do you think that they're going to stay with the status quo?
That's a good question, because I think that the replacements, I don't want to call them the replacements, but I can't think, the successors. Okay, let's call them the successors. I think Dominique is an apparent successor to Carl Wettstein, in that, you know, she leans left, he leans left, and he's still with us, although he's not on council. I don't want to imply that Carl Wettstein is no longer with us. But, you know, that I think the expectation there is that she will be easily be able to sidle into his spot.
Right.
Just in terms of that sort of almost reliably lefty vote. But Rodrigo Galler, I'd be interested to see what he does. Because I think he's very community minded, and, you know, he used to work for the city. Now he's his own independent business person. So, you know, he understands both sides of that, being, you know, someone in the community, being someone in council now, someone being on staff, but now he's on council. So he almost understands all three sides of the, or at least he will after a couple of meetings, you know, all three sides of the proverbial triangle: staff, council, you know, citizen.
Right.
So he's the big question mark. I'm not sure how he will fit into the dynamics. I don't believe in the whole Gang of Seven malarkey, but there are easy to see sort of where there are alignments, and I'm not sure exactly where Rodrigo is going to align, or if he might, you know. I know that he won't be akin to Andy. I mean, he's talked a lot about having like monthly town halls and that kind of thing. So he's clearly very constituent minded, as Andy was. But in terms of style, Andy was very much like, I'm going to read these reports. If I have questions, I'll ask staff. They'll give me my answers. Yeah. I will have my answers, and I don't have to put on a show in council to get answers. And a lot of people mocked him for it.
Yeah.
But I think that was his style.
Whatever gets the job done, though, right?
Right. Yeah. Whatever gets the job done. But, you know, his focus was very much on the constituent stuff, and, you know, he didn't have to put on make a speech. And when he did talk in council, it was usually something consequential, and it was usually a question that, you know, may have been overlooked or may have been on the minds of everyone who just didn't know how to articulate it. Yeah. And so I think that's what I will be watching, is what moves Councillor Galler makes.
One question on and counselor designate caller for the moment.
Yeah, well, I think we talked about this with Dominique on open sources that counselor elect is the proper
term. Oh yeah, yeah. was he part of the so-called slate type thing?
Rodrigo, yeah, he was one of the two who were campaigning with Cam in War 2.
So he was the only person, only new person,
right,
that was part of that. So I wonder, you know, will that come into play at all? What do you think on that? I'm curious because there was some backlash against it from other candidates and from people at Doors and however, you know. But I'm curious whether that will actually have any effect on council.
I don't think it'll have any effect at all.
No.
I think that if you're sort of that easily persuaded that, you know, you're just going to go wherever the mayor goes, you're probably just getting into it for the wrong reasons, which is just be like that sort of party person. But, you know, I think looking back on it now, like a month later, you know, it's... I almost feel it's silly now. That whole thing was silly. I think we all took it a little too seriously. And I think it was bigger. I think the whole controversy of it became bigger than probably the mayor intended. I think probably looking backward, he probably wouldn't have done it. I mean, I don't know for sure because I'm not in his head. But yeah. I can imagine that, you know, there were some unintended consequences of that. But I can't imagine there's going to be much of an effect. And like I said, I've always found that slate stuff to be silly because, you know, you can find examples of meetings where people voted 10-3 or 11-2 or, you know, this got passed with the support of every councillor of any political stripe. It, you know, the Hydro decision is a big one. I think that was a 10-3 decision.
Right.
But, you know, I'm not sure it'll play a role in the fact that I don't think anybody's really talked about it since the election, the whole slate thing. It's, I don't know. I think we're sort of put enough distance in it that we've able to sort of contextualize that as a controversy looking for a reason, looking for a controversy or something that it's, you know, in an election where there wasn't too much controversy, it gave us much needed controversy.
The most controversy was, one of the things was the no signs from one of the mayoral candidates.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that was one of the bigger headlines of because it was just unusual.
Right.
I mean, maybe you can think of other ones that are bigger too, but that was one I found interesting. One as a candidate, and two as just an observer. It was kind of different, right? Especially from a candidate who just used signs like a couple months prior.
Right. It's keep in mind too that signs are expensive. You know that.
Yep, they are.
So you know, if you're running sort of like a grassroots indie campaign, you don't have the party apparatus behind you. Maybe that's a bit easier to skip the sign purchases. But I mean, I think we talked about that before. Offline, so to speak. But you know, when you're in that kind of situation where you're running against a strong incumbent who doesn't really have any controversy or scandal behind him, and you know, you're sort of running as the option B candidate, you can take that time to, you know, experiment with the form,
try new things.
And I think, I mean, she's still got 35% of the vote.
Yeah.
So
there you go.
You know, maybe in certain instances, you know, you can get away with going signless. But, I mean, it's an interesting question to come, but it's also an interesting thing to think about that, and you may have better insights on this than I do, that the old-fashioned campaigning stuff, the door-knocking, the signs,
right,
the town halls, the debates, still gets you more attention or gets you more engaged than the Facebook posts and the Twitter posts and Instagram and all that.
Well, we had the whole thing with the Facebook groups during the election that was quite intense. But, you know, and I found I didn't reach a lot of people through social media as much as I thought I was going to, especially someone who's in, like, communications and who's used social media for a while for different things, including in, like, a paid role as well. And I've never... I thought it would be a lot more influential, but it wasn't. And you're right. It's the traditional going to doors was the biggest thing. Going to events was like, okay, you were there. You know, that's kind of cool. At the beginning, it was important because it got the name out, right? Say, you know, this person is running. This is what he looks like. especially before we got signs on the road, right? So relative nobody to, you know, Guelph sort of.
Guelph famous.
Yeah, well, I don't know about famous, but, you know, somebody.
Right.
I still get people saying, hi, how are you? And I have no clue who they are, but like, thank you.
thank you for recognizing me.
Yeah. I exist. No, but it was cool because I met a lot of really politically active people in Guelph who've been on campaigns, met politicians of all political stripes, and then I was getting advice from a lot of different people, and it was cool because, you know, some had their different strategies, but there was one thing that they all said, and it was door knocking is so important because you get there, you show your face, you fight for a sign. It's always fighting for that sign because to show that there's one way to show support, and it's to get a sign on the lawn, right? And that's usually how you judge how you'll do in an election. So that's why my result was a little shocking to me, but you know, yeah, it is what it is. Not bitter about it. But I think that, it's like you said, the traditional thing is still. And I wish more people came out to the debate because I think it was really cool. And I wish it was longer. I wish we had more time to talk. And I don't know if you had that with other candidates. Like, did they say the same thing? They wish they had more time? Or
I think everybody always wishes they had more time.
Yeah.
I think especially in the municipal campaign where you still have to go to work from 9 to 5 and then.
Yeah, that's true.
But one of the things I will say, having gone to a lot of the debates, is that the Ward 4 debate was probably the tightest. And I'm not just saying that because I'm a Ward 4 resident, but the organizers of that debate really had it together in terms of, like, it felt like a debate. Everyone was respectful, but there was still, like, some mixing it up. And despite how many candidates there were, the format was really good. I think that was one of the better debates of the campaign.
Right.
But, yeah.
The only thing I had with that was I felt like we were getting asked questions that you could easily find on our websites. And the point of debates was I was like, can you please get to the nitty gritty? Like questions like, what would you drop from the budget to fund this thing on your platform? Or what would you do to do? Like, and I watched some of the other ones and also followed some of your coverage. And I felt like they got better questions sometimes. And maybe this is kind of a cool idea I had in my head, and maybe I'll bring it out on this podcast, is that it would be neat if we had one, if we had a debate in every ward that was hosted by the same person, maybe a media person in Guelph, such as yourself, so that it was... Well, maybe more fair in the sense that everybody gets the same treatment, right? Does that mean, I don't know if that makes a lot of sense, if that's a good tangent or not, but just for democracy's sake, I guess.
Well, I think in 2014, there was like ward debates hosted by the chamber. That makes sense. That's a lot of work, though.
Yeah.
And I think we're still struggling with... I don't want to say it's because the Mercury's gone, but I mean, just the changing media landscape makes it a struggle in terms of how people engage with things and how people watch things, you know, sort of depending on Rogers is folly because people are cord cutting because there's other options out there. Maybe this is something we have to figure out before the next election too, is just, you know, in a changing media landscape, how do we assure that, how do we, first of all, ensure fairness for the candidates in terms of their exposure and their debating? How do we ensure people are getting the best possible information about the candidates and the platforms? How do we, you know, share, you know, debates and you know, is, you know, what's the best way to do that? You know, those are like big questions, and that'll be answered, but hopefully before 2022. For 2018... December 3rd, 2018. Are you going to be there opening night?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah, that'll be good. I can hopefully see some of the people I was, you know, on the campaign trail with. You meet a lot of candidates, right? Which is kind of neat, and you make some good connections. So it'd be cool to reconnect and, you know, see, I've reconnected with a few mm-hmm. since then and gone out for coffee and things like that. I mean, there's cool. a federal election coming up, so.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, people are, the political buzz has not died down yet.
Political buzz, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, good. Looking forward to the next election already. Awesome. Well, Eli, thanks so much for taking part, and we're going to try and do this again on a monthly basis. And in the meantime, how can people connect with you? Tell people how they can connect with you.
Yeah, well, you can find me on Twitter at Eli Ritter, ELIRIDDER. Pretty easy. You know, Facebook, same thing. Instagram, same thing. So if you want to send me an email, ElyRitter@iCloud.com. If you have Guelph story ideas, that's always good. And yeah.
Because you'll be contributing to Politico in a substantive way and doing these, again, hopefully monthly podcasts. And so we'll
looking forward to it.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
All right. See you next month. Or if not sooner.
Yeah.
And once again, that was Eli Ritter. Eli will be back next month with more Guelph stuff. And in the meantime, you should start being able to read his stuff on Guelph Politico in the near future. If you liked Guelph stuff, let us know. And if you have an idea for a subject you'd like us to talk about, let us know that too. And that's it for the Guelph Politicast this week. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics at Sid Dale. The host for the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes. And while you're there, you can also listen to Open Source's Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. You can go to the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And, of course, if you'd like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, then please consider donating to Guelph Politico. And you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. For all the latest local political news, check out Guelph Politico. .ca, where we will have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly, and until then, we will see you next time.